participation. So I thought that was interesting.
Well, it was about an inch-by-inch box, and for the record, about a month after session was over, and if you didn't flip it over when you got it in the mail, you probably wouldn't have seen it. Mm-hmm. Well, but anyway, be that as it may, was there a because the notification, as this bill is written, and as I misread it initially, the people that have to get notice of the duty to report is much broader, is much narrower than those that have to be trained.
You're right. I think you're right.
Was that mm-hmm. your intent?
No, I don't. We didn't have a discussion about that. It was just the big picture of saying anyone who's...
So those that are getting notice ought to correspond with those that are being trained.
Yes, that would work just fine.
That's helpful.
Mm-hmm. That would be fine with us.
Further questions? Representative Maddox, did you have a question? I thought you did.
I did before, actually. First question is, in regard to the statute here and the new language that we'd be putting in regarding the certification of training, shouldn't we expand that to be not just child sexual abuse, but add the phrase and child abuse?
That would be, Mr. Chair, that would be fine with us. We were just focusing on the sex abuse.
Secondly, I assume that the bar can provide some of this training in terms of mandatory legal education programs where lawyers have to get credits every year and everything. I'm concerned about us coming at this so sort of backwards. We're going to say all these organizations are going to require evidence of the training. Is it because we're having difficulty coming forward and just saying, here's the training and you must take this training, or we want to give them a variety of training sources? Why have we come at it that way and just said, well, you've got to bring evidence of training. This is the new provision.
Well, I'm having a difficult time.
All right. The bill says you've got to come in with evidence of training.
Mm-hmm.
Why didn't we just set up a training program and tell everybody they have to take that training program?
Oh, I think, Mr. Chair, Representative Maddox, what we were thinking of initially is that we knew that Children's Services was developing some curriculum and that could be shared, and then the organizations that license or certify professionals could just use that and use whatever mechanism they have available currently, either in service through the schools or continuing ed days, and they could use that material. And we just thought it would be easy rather than trying to develop a whole training site or program.
Follow up on that? Well, my next concern then is we're saying you have to provide this evidence of training. There's somewhere around 8,000 lawyers in the state now.
10, I believe.
10,000 lawyers now. Maybe 1,000 of them are regularly involved with children. For instance, in my practice, since I left the Attorney General's office, I don't deal with children's issues. I deal with litigation and insurance. And are we overdoing it if we say all of those people have to provide certification of training?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix, I think that was the issue that Ms. Robinson was getting at, and that is with the language that maybe narrows for those people that are practicing in that
yeah.
area or have
same
contact.
Same language as we have in the earlier mm-hmm. section.
Right.
I probably was reading some mm-hmm. of this material during that
mm-hmm. I think that would, because I think that was the concern of the bar. I mean, when I talked
right.
with a representative yesterday, that made sense.
And I think every other professional licensing.
Right, right. I think that the sense that I'm getting from the committee in terms of some questions and some notes is that very interested in the bill, also interested in seeing some narrowing language so that we're not overstating the requirement.
Thank
so.
You.
All right, Ms. White, thank you very much. We have someone who has come all the way from Sisters, Susan Connor. Ms. Connor signed up to testify in favor of the bill. We want to welcome you to the Judiciary Committee and the subcommittee. Appreciate you coming over and ask for you to give us your testimony.
I'm glad to be here, Representative Clark. My name is Susan Connor, and I'm here today to explain to you why I believe it is so important to pass this bill. If this had been required years ago, I might not have been the mother of a sexually abused boy. My son would not have been charged with first-degree murder for killing his abuser. My family would not have been devastated both financially and emotionally. My son said that what happened to him was worse than death. Let me explain. My son's perpetrator, Edwin Dar, had been allegedly sexually abusing young boys in Boy Scouts and in the Mormon Church for over 30 years. His actions had been reported to the police and to the church numerous times, years before my son became a victim. The police chose not to pursue an investigation or report it to CSD. They did not understand sexual abuse. How do I know this? Because I talked to them and I asked them why they hadn't done anything. These were good police officers. They just didn't understand predatory homosexual pedophiles. Because of their ignorance, they chose not to pursue the evidence that was available concerning Dyer's discharge from scouting and his disfellowship from the Mormon Church. Unfortunately, Dyer continued to molest kids in other youth-related areas. Would these police officers have sought this information if it had been available? No, they would not. I found out that the Deschutes County Mental Health Department, they were aware of this ignorance of the police department. They offered to arrange a training workshop on child sex abuse. The police departments declined. They did not feel it was important. Two high school teachers and a Mormon church leader and counselor were aware of Dyer's problems. One of them reported it to the police. If they had been trained in sexual abuse, they might have discussed their concerns with trained people at CSD. One of the teachers, who was a longtime friend of Dyer's, spoke in favor of him at the sentencing. His trivialization of Dyer's actions made it obvious that he didn't understand anything about homosexual pedophiles. Many people don't realize how damaging sexual abuse can be to a child. People need to learn how it ruins lives. One of Dyer's victims had been molested by Dyer since the age of 12. When this victim became a father, he molested his own children and beat his wife and got a jail term. He finally realized with counseling that his life had been severely damaged by Ed Dyer. A man who had tried for years to have Dyer investigated finally contacted an Oregon State police officer who had had training in sexual abuse. Within 2 weeks, Dyer was investigated and arrested. My son and another boy agreed to testify against Dyer. My son felt that he was first a victim of Dyer and then a victim of the legal system. He became emotionally disturbed because an adequate restraining order was against Dyer was declined, and Dyer only received 20 days in jail after admitting to abusing boys for over 30 years. The legal system failed because the district attorneys, the pre-sentence investigator, and the judge were not trained in understanding sexual abuse. They failed to find out the facts. After declaring the sentence, the judge consoled Dyer and told him that he was a fine fellow and had done a great deal for the community and that he hoped that these episodes would not mar his life. This is on public record. We need a law to enforce training to recognize child sexual abuse so that mandated reporters will realize the symptoms, the seriousness, and the consequences of child sexual abuse. I feel that the cost of this training would be a bargain for the taxpayers in the long term because disturbed children grow up to become unproductive and disturbed adults, and they often end up in the criminal justice system, which costs the society a great deal. If this bill is passed, it will be another step in helping to combat the horrendous problem of child sexual abuse in our society. The children are the future of our society. Thank you.
Questions? Dr. Connor, we want to thank you for coming all the way over, and we appreciate your testimony. Let's take a 5-minute recess.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Mannix.
Do we have some groups who are testifying in opposition because of the apparent breadth of the
certification? Well, I don't know. I want to try and call up several of the people who are opposed and ask them to come up and, as a group, and we'll talk
about
that.
Because we may have some language that can narrow it down, and we could move with it instead of letting them continue to worry about what may be ghosts.
I think we'd clean this up some.
Right. I am going to ask Dan Reese and Demi Rewick, if those people are around, to from Sacred Heart Hospital in Eugene, to come on up.
Thank you, Representative Clark.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Members of the committee, my name is Dan Reese. I'm a social work supervisor at Sacred Heart Hospital in Eugene. As some of you are probably aware, Sacred Heart is a comprehensive medical care center. We employ 36 social workers at Sacred Heart in most every area of treatment, in most every program within the hospital. And I should note that the social work staff at Sacred Heart is required by policy to be involved in any child welfare matter that arises within the hospital. House Bill 2397 seeks to require that all mandated reporters of child abuse undergo training in legal, medical, and psychological aspects of child sexual abuse. We want to say at the outset that we fully support the intent of this law, which we believe to be and which we assume to be to improve the early identification and intervention on behalf of child abuse victims. Healthcare workers, I believe, and human service workers, I believe, are particularly sensitive to these issues because they, in a very firsthand and personal way, experience the devastating effects of child abuse, and that we're strongly in favor of measures that seek to improve our response to protect kids. I might add that on a personal note, having been a child abuse investigator and also a person involved in treatment for children and families, I'm very concerned that we do the best and most efficient job possible in intervening on their behalf. We do have some concerns about the bill, however, some questions about the bill and some reservations, some of those of which have been already brought up this afternoon. They relate to the specific pool of people that would be encompassed in the bill. We also have concerns and some questions about whether or not it would be wise to limit the requirement to child sexual abuse alone, as opposed to the broader subject of child abuse as defined in other parts of the code.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Mannix.
Just to save us a little time this afternoon, I think we picked up the sense of the committee and earlier witnesses that we're all willing to broaden this to be a child abuse education program, including child sexual abuse as part of that. Mm-hmm. So any other witnesses, and yourself included, you might jump over that point unless someone else here thinks that I'm crazy in perceiving that. I think we can just go beyond that.
Sure, you bet. I'll try and skip ahead to two additional concerns that maybe haven't been addressed yet this afternoon. We believe that for any bill of this nature to be successful, the content of the training is critical. Yet we don't see in this bill anything specific to a quality control mechanism that would assure the appropriate training is provided to specific types of mandated professionals. It is conceivable that all the institutions required to report child abuse would develop their own programs, go to the trouble and expense to implement the programs, train thousands of mandated reporters, all for nothing if the curriculum is flawed or inappropriate or inadequate. I think to some degree that was raised earlier, and I think that it's important to keep in mind that a mandate alone does not ensure quality.
Representative Edmondson, excuse us.
Excuse me for interrupting you, but the law That's now fine. Requires CSD to establish the curriculum for these training programs, and generally, not just for child abuse,
mm-hmm.
including assessment of risk to the child, dynamics of child abuse and child sexual abuse, and legally sound and age-appropriate interview and investigatory techniques. Doesn't that address your concern that there be a sort of a a guideline followed for these sorts of training programs?
Well, I believe the degree to which CSD has made materials available and has actively been involved, the gentleman from CSD earlier, for example, had stated that they had developed at a certain cost some materials specific to child abuse. I know our hospital has received those materials. We've used them. We've provided on an ongoing basis continuing education for our staff. As a matter of fact, we have another joint meeting with CSD scheduled for the 29th to in-service our staff that are working specifically with kids. I think the problem is that to a large degree, what is out there is not known to be out there, and there are a lot of mandated reporters that that do not have ready access or even aware of what materials are there. By and large, I think that specifically healthcare providers and human service professionals, once they are made aware of specific programs, and I think the best kind of programs, by the way, do not involve written material, they do not involve slideshows, they do not involve videotape presentations. They require an interactive process where CSD would make themselves available to work with specific professionals. I have worked as a social worker in a state that requires the type of training that is addressed in this bill, that being Iowa. And 6 years ago, this kind of mandated training was enacted. And I had an opportunity to witness the kind of training that was made available to professionals before and after the mandate was put in place. It was my own experience and observation that although there were not the numbers of people that were exposed to the literature before the mandated training was enacted, the quality that was available before the mandate was put into place was much higher. There were training teams that circulated around the state to meet with mandatory reporters. At the point that there was a mandate put in place and enacted, at that point there was, I think, a two-hour requirement, and it took place in the employment setting with the employers providing the training, and it was largely making use of slideshows and videos, which it was my observation the mandatory reporters made little use of. And that the quality fell off as a result. I'm not saying that the mandate made the quality of the training lessen, but it certainly didn't ensure that the quality of the training was where it needed to be. There's some specifics in the bill that I think that are significant. The bill does not address, for example, how much training would need to be made available. It does not address how often that training should be made available, to what degree there should be updated training available, for example. And it's these kinds of details I think are very important. I think the time to address those issues are now, before a bill of this nature is enacted, rather than after it's enacted and in the administrative rules process. Currently, hospitals and hospital social work departments in this state are facing some unforeseen complications and unforeseen costs in implementing mandates that arose from the last session of the legislature. So we're a bit sensitive right now to wanting to, at the point of discussion of this type of legislation, have input into the specifics of it rather than to leave that vague and leave it up to the administrative rules process to iron out. Okay. Demi was going to address a little bit more about the cost concerns.
Hi, my name is Demi Ruick, and I'm one of the nursing directors at Sacred Heart. House Bill 2397 has cost implications for the hospital and other affected agencies. I thought you'd want to be aware of them as you consider this bill. And frankly, just as significant as the cost to us is the effect on public agencies who, with ballot measure 5, can probably ill afford to provide such extensive training. Therefore, it might be advisable for the state to consider enlisting the voluntary support and cooperation of all affected agencies before mandating it by law. Especially in the healthcare professions, I can tell you that we take as our professional obligation the mandated reporting very, very seriously. And frankly, to mandate the training for that reporting seems like overkill to us. In our nursing division alone, there are some 1,200 employees, 700 of whom would come into the category of having some potential contact with children and would require training. When you include just in the hospital setting our social workers, chaplains, psychologists, and the physicians who are employed by the hospital, the number approaches 800, which is about half of our full-time equivalents. the cost of providing training to our nursing staff alone would exceed $50,000, and that assumes a four-hour training. The cost of providing records to the state to demonstrate compliance with the law would be added to that. Multiply this cost times the number of nurses, social workers, chaplains, psychologists, and physicians in the state, and the cost approaches $1 million for hospitals alone. And, of course, that amount would be added to the health care bill for the state. Thanks for giving me this opportunity to speak to you. Dan and I would both be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you. Representative Mannix.
It seems to me that we're going to be hearing a lot of from people about costs and problems, and I think the chair is going to be following up on this, but it seems to me the thing to do is get all the concerned groups together and put together three package education programs, the one-hour package, the half-day package, and the full-day package, the full freight deal, put together some voluntary funding, put the package together, and then mandate that certain licensed people have to have that package provided to them at certain times, but have the package in mind when you mandate it, and have, for instance, with the bar, I know what the mandatory continuing legal education program is all about. I know where it fits, and we pay for it. And if, for instance, with your nurses, they have to renew their licenses. They have certain nursing credits, I assume, that they have to get at some point for renewal.
Actually, nurses don't have a mandatory continuing ed requirement. A relicensing.
Don't let him write that down.
Right.
Well, then maybe this will be a first step in that direction for those, because I know there's a minimum service requirement for nurses
That's
to maintain
correct.
Their licenses.
That's right.
But if we can get all those groups together to work out some, you know, package A, B, C, some people who are minimally involved probably can get by with the A package so that they've got some minimal knowledge. At the same time, it could be something, though, that ties in with all of the other professional programs. And I'll pass it back to the chairman, because he's the one who has the idea about getting these folks together and just saying, look, okay, everyone agrees this is a good idea. We've got lots of problems, and maybe we shouldn't be mandating it this way. Well, let's put together a package, though, and at some point maybe we'll mandate that kind of standardized program, which is what you're really getting at, I think.
And I agree. The time to do that is now rather than later on when you iron out the wrinkles after there's a law in place.
I think it'd be wonderful, for instance, if we had a one-hour package slideshow or videotape program, and you could send that out to employers. And I'll just mention a last comment, Mr. Chairman. I know the Workers' Compensation Division did that in regard to some safety program that everyone was required to have. And it was a good way of packaging something in a standardized format that was broadly available and explained a lot of questions.
Thank you. I would like to ask both of you whether you would be willing to work with some of the other folks who are concerned about the bill, as well as some of the proponents, in trying to come up with some clarifying language on a variety of points, which we will give you some direction about in a few minutes. Will you be willing to make yourself available to do that?
I would try and do that. I'm going to be out of the country in a few weeks for about 3 months, but I'm sure that Sacred Heart and the Social Work Department and Sacred Heart as a whole would like to participate in that.
You're not going to do that before the legislative session's over, are you?
In about 3 weeks.
Can I go with you?
You mean you would honestly go out of the country while this drama is playing out here in
this one.
Oregon legislature? My gosh.
Kenya, actually.
You would rather go to Kenya than stick around and watch the legislature?
It's a tough choice.
Absolutely incredible. All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to ask Scott Gallant from the OMA and Joseph Benninghoff from COSA to come up at the same time, and I think you understand the reason why, as well as, where did he go?
Mr. Brian DeLashmet wanted to.
Mr. DeLashmet.
He may not have been able to stay.
All right, and Mr. Carl Myers from the bar still here? Any representative from the bar? Speaking of the devil, would you come on in? We just called your name. Scott, would you kick us off, please?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Scott Gallant. I'm with the Oregon Medical Association. This topic is obviously a very serious one, and one that physicians do take very seriously. For your information, in 1981, there were 10,624 reported abuse cases, child abuse cases. 1990, there were 23,820, according to CSD. I think that people, obviously, given those numbers, do take this very, very seriously. The Board of Medical Examiners, as required by the previous statute, has sent information as required to physicians who who deal with children. In addition to that, again, for your information, the Health Sciences University had 33 lectures in 1990 on child abuse. 24 were on the Hill itself, 9 were in other parts of the state. My point being that I think the issue is whether or not you have a state program that requires something to be done in a particular way, or in fact whether we can, as you mentioned, or maybe Representative Mannix mentioned, whether or not we might be able to get the players together and see if we can't do something voluntarily that is adaptable to the times as they change. The numbers of people that you're talking about that are currently required in the statute have to be conservatively estimated for those who are required to report at 120,000 people. If you look at the list, excluding any county sheriff's office, I don't know how a sheriff's office is, how an office reports, but I assume it's the employees of that office. You have every employee of the Department of Human Resources, County Health Department, Community Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities Program, County Juvenile Department, Licensed Child Caring Agency, Peace Officer, Psychologist, Clergyman, Clinical Social Worker, Optometrist, Chiropractor, Certified Provider of Daycare, Foster Care, or an employee thereof, Attorney, Naturopathic Physician, Licensed Professional Counselor, Licensed Marriage and Family Therapist, Firefighters, Emergency Medical Technicians, Law Enforcement Agent, well, that's as well as, obviously, physicians, dentists, every school employee, and licensed practical nurse or registered nurse. Nurses alone, according to what I was told just recently, there are approximately 40,000 registered nurses, not all of whom, obviously, are practicing, and obviously not all of whom would deal with children. And I know that's becoming something of a redundant comment to the committee. But those are massive numbers, and clearly people are reporting. But I think often in these instances, and I've seen a lot of good ideas of mandates to provide education that can often be done very well on a voluntary basis if we take the resources that are currently being used, really identifying the particular areas that may not be up to speed, you know, either particular groups or whatever, and see if we can't target that on our own effort. We'd be more than willing to participate in that.
Mr. Chairman?
Right. I'm going to ask the committee to hold the questions so the panel gets through, and then we'll have a chance to ask questions. Mr. Benninghoff.
My name is Joseph C. Benninghoff. I'm employed by the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Would just make two or three comments. One considerable comment has been made regarding the lack of training as it relates to the failure to report. We are very concerned about the failure to report, and this was an issue that spending a number of years as a school district personnel director, I had to deal with, as people would call and say, do you think I need to report this? And the best I could do would be to read the law and say, if it fits, yes, you do need to report it. I am concerned that it is sometimes the political sensitivity of the issue rather than lack of understanding that leads people not to report when reports should have been made. Now, maybe adequate training will solve that problem.
That's a very interesting comment. What do you mean by that?
I think the lady from Sisters described essentially political situations.
Okay. And I said I was going to ask the panel to wait to ask questions, and I didn't do that. Go ahead.
I'm not exactly sure how the education community fits in to the proposed language. For those public or private officials who are not licensed, there is one provision. Those people are not now notified, but this would include not all, but most of our classified or non-certificated employees do deal with children, so I assume they would come under that provision. The last sentence in the bill, I assume, would refer to the certificated staff. Again, we have a kind of awkward situation. They're like the nurses, our certificated staff has no continuing professional development requirement. As a matter of fact, that is forbidden, as far as teachers are concerned, by state statute. We would be very pleased to join with others to talk about this bill and to see what we could bring out of it in terms of programs that would be workable and helpful.
Thank you. Mr. Myers from the bar, do you have anything to add to those comments? I know you weren't prepared to testify and we sort of drafted you, but would you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Carl Myers, an attorney practicing in Salem, appearing on behalf of the Oregon State Bar. Let me say that the Oregon State Bar fully endorses the concept of this bill. From a practical point of view, I might point out we have some difficulty in identifying the people who may be subject to this. I might also point out at this point that I have with me Jerry Banks of the from the board of the Mandatory Continuing Legal Education. So if there, the committee has questions about MCLE and its applications, I'd certainly be happy to have him here. But as you know, the Bar Association is comprised of over 10,000 lawyers, and rough estimates would put perhaps 90% of those lawyers do not come in contact with children or be subject to the notice. We do have the family law.
Let me give you just a couple of instances. I was working with a young boy who at the time was five. He was molested by a family member, an adolescent cousin. Had he had to testify, this would have been extremely hard on him. He had not spoken to any physicians about it. He had not spoken to any lawyers, and he wouldn't have. He had his mother had spoken indirectly to me, and I had spoken to him. And that's the way it came up. I think that's only one particular instance, and I think a lot of things happen that way. Also, as you may well know, CSD often mandates evaluations of possible sexual abuse, and psychologists are asked to do those evaluations. Therefore, I think they should be allowed to testify. I would like to ask for one possible other consideration here. This says, extends the hearsay exception to for statements by a child victim of sexual conduct and the child is under 10. There are often victims of sexual conduct who are developmentally disabled, who are over 10, who are functionally 10 or under, and I think some words would be, it would be good to put in some words to deal with that situation, that is to extend the hearsay exception to older developmentally disabled individuals, because the pressures on them of testifying in court are the same as those.
Which, as I understand it, is not an infrequent occurrence because of their vulnerability.
Right. In fact, I was recently working with a case like that. So.
Actually, a higher incidence.
Yeah, that would make sense. All right, thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Mannix.
Now, which version would you support? We have two versions of language here. One is broader than the other, and I may have missed this particular fine point.
The one I'm supporting is, in particular, which includes psychologists, clinical social workers, and licensed marriage and family therapists.
So we'd use the Chapter 675 language there.
All right,
thank
yes.
you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix.
Learned Counsel.
Let me just point out why I did this, and there was a reason why I tried to look through an alternative, and I think it's particularly germane given the conversation today. If you look on page 410, it says a psychotherapist means a person who is licensed, registered, certified, or otherwise authorized by the laws of the state to engage in the diagnosis, or be reasonably believed by the patient to be while so engaged. And I, given the testimony that this committee has had, and the fact that we do license people now, and last session the legislature enacted the Family and Marriage Counseling Board, I believe that most people that would be treating would be falling within that category. But I thought that that would be somewhat problematic to certain individuals and felt that the other one was cleaner.
Which one do you feel that Chapter 675
is cleaner? Because those people are, and, but we did broaden it. Last session, before licensed and family counselors were licensed, there were a lot of people that were viewed as being good treatment professionals but who were not yet licensed. They're now licensed.
Thank you.
All right. Representative Sanseri.
I'll ask after.
Right. Mr. Bennett, have you have anything to add?
No, I have nothing to add.
Oh, then I do have a question.
Representative Sanseri.
I have a lingering concern. While I am substantially in support of this, the concern I have is, what about children who exaggerate at that age? What about children who don't give the whole picture? And we're saying we want to allow this maybe questionable testimony that could incriminate a person and have incredible impact on their lives. A person who is even falsely accused of such activity, I'm not sure that they ever recover from that.
I think that's a good question, Representative Mannix.
Sanseri.
Sorry, Sanseri. I'm looking down the wrong angle here. Forgive me.
You've just offended them both, by the way.
God, is there anybody else I could offend here now while I'm going at it?
I'm just
I think children who, for whatever reason, either undertell or overtell, are more likely to do so, in fact, in a court setting than they are in a more comfortable interview setting. There isn't any question that that sort of thing occurs, and I could begin to go into the circumstances in which it's likely to occur. In fact, its rate of occurrence is probably over-exaggerated, because the difficult truth is that very often you can't tell from what a young child says what exactly did or didn't happen. But I think the point is well taken. I think the best way is to get the information as accurately as you're likely to get it, which is not going to be in an open court setting.
And, Reverend Sanseri, if I can add, I'm going to ask Mr. Gardner to address this when he comes up. There were a number of what I'll call safeguards written into the statute last session to try and make sure that the statement itself, the isolated statement itself, was not the be-all and the end-all. And I'll ask Mr. Gardner to address that when he comes up. So, further questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate you being here.
Thank you very
much.
Thank
you.
All right. Mr. Gardner, we appreciate you coming over from Bend. And you've been out of the country to Kenya or some such place as well.
I was only in Kentucky.
Is there a difference? That's for it.
You'll have to answer. They're in the same direction.
Same direction. Distance. All right. And you have brought us also some proposed amendments. And maybe what you could do is, the committee will recall last time that Mr. Gardner walked us through the bill. It was the first time that any member of the committee ever had understood the hearsay rule from law school or since then. And for that, Mr. Gardner, we are forever in your debt. Can you remind us of the reason for the bill, very quickly what the bill does, and then explain to us your proposed amendment?
My name is Chris Gardner, and I'm a deputy district attorney in Deschutes County, representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I as well brought two documents that I presented to each member of the committee. And if I could just briefly describe those, take about 30 seconds. One is from a publication entitled When the Child is a Victim. I included the cover of that document in the handout, published by the U.S. Department of Justice. Primarily, I got the first chapter of that because it has a chart of probably the most complete studies of the incidence of child sexual abuse, and that would be on page 3 of that handout, and that begins with the Kinsey study published in 1953 and runs through a study in Canada done in 1984. Secondly, I provided an excerpt from a book by John Crutzen called By Silence Betrayed. If anybody would like to sign a solemn oath to return it, I'd be glad to loan them this book, which discusses an L.A. Times poll that once again confirmed the basic figures in when the victim is a child. As well, I excerpted from that the discussion and the poll's results concerning the number of people who are perpetrators of child abuse. And the reason I did that is that it is so hard to believe this that I felt some documentation may be helpful. I can provide both publications in further detail and would urge you, if you want to look into the matter further, to read Mr. Crutzen's book from a lay perspective, probably one of the most thorough examinations of the phenomena that I've seen published. As to the one other matter I'd like to address because somebody brought it up out in the hall. Dr. Connor and I have worked closely on a project we're working on in Deschutes County, and I was not in the Deschutes County District Attorney's Office at the time of the incident she described, which she apologized that she hadn't brought that up to me, but I'd like to bring that to your attention.
No, we appreciate that. I understand it.
The proposals that I'm recommending and the changes I'm recommending fall into, I believe, four separate areas. The first of those are some relatively minor changes that would affect the application of this bill in a criminal case where there is an unavailable child victim, which is really the nexus of what this bill was about. And I had described that we don't admit hearsay because we find it frequently untrustworthy. And in this situation where a person's liberty is at stake, their reputation, the possibility they may be convicted of a crime, I frankly cannot find in good conscience that it's appropriate to significantly erode the protections of the Confrontation Clause and the hearsay rule. But I would make two recommendations in that circumstance. And the first would be that we change a single word in the bills and the rules that exist, and that is change the word describes to the word concerns.
Where are you?
And I'm on page 3, line 2.
Now you brought that up during your testimony last time.
Right.
You also had some changes on line 10.
Yes.
And changing, make it to be line 10, alleged perpetrator's opportunity to participate rather than participation.
Right. And the reason I recommend that, if you look down on line 42, one of the factors that in determining indicia of reliability that was set forth was whether extrinsic evidence exists to show accused opportunity to commit the act which the child statement refers. That is no longer available as indicia of reliability pursuant to the Idaho case.
And you would like us to take out lines 42 and 43 on page 3, as I recall?
Right, and just include the context of that in the requirement of the alleged perpetrator's participation. Just make that corroborative evidence of the alleged perpetrator's opportunity to participate.
May I follow up on that?
Representative Mannix.
You, we've had a proposed amendment to line 44 to open that up to say this subsection applies to all civil, criminal, and juvenile court proceedings. When I looked at that, I wondered if we should go back up to the earlier, up higher up on page 3 of this bill, because there's a point where we talk about, I think, criminal proceedings. I see, we took out the phrase there. So since we're taking it out there and we're putting in a separate provision, that'll cover all yes. three situations. Did you have more changes in this paragraph, this long paragraph on page 3?
Yes, I did. And they're basically included in the proposed draft, although I've got to admit I think that's fairly inartfully done. And if it's the committee's will that we move in this direction, I'd be glad to work with counsel to artfully make
Let's
these changes.
Well, which are, may I follow up?
Representative Mannix, let me ask Mr. Gardner to go through all of his proposed changes and then...
That's what I'm trying to find out. Yep. Are there any more major changes in that paragraph?
Yes.
All right. Go ahead.
The second would allow the hearsay statements of the child concerning the abuse if she or he are available and actually testifies regardless of their age. And the reason for that is that frequently, as a matter of fact, most frequently when we bring one of these cases to trial, what we have is the child's account of events and the denial of the perpetrator. And the only other evidence that's available, even in the best of cases, now occasionally, I mean, and very rarely, we'll get something like, you know, a tattoo in the private area of the perpetrator or a videotape that the perpetrator made. But generally, we don't have that evidence. And to the extent that we have physical evidence, it's equivocal. It would be evidence of trauma, for instance, regressive behaviors in a young child, starting to bedwet or something, that could be associated with other trauma besides sexual abuse. Or there could be physical evidence, hymenal notching or tearing, which once again could be associated with rather bizarre other activities, but with something else besides sexual abuse. So
what's the proposed amendment?
Generally available to us, no additional conclusive evidence. So what this would do, what I would propose, is that we allow the hearsay discussed in here into evidence without any control, as long as the child's available and testifies. Because one of the more compelling bits of evidence we have, either to prove or disprove the allegations, is how did the child talk about this to other people? Who did she tell first? How did they tell them? What were their observations of the child when she told or he told about it?
What you're really doing is suggesting that that the exception not be limited to the situations where the child is, quote, unavailable.
But it is not limited to that now.
Okay. So I guess I'm still unclear on what the proposed amendment would be.
Okay.
And where in the bill it would go.
Okay. In essence, what it would do would be allow that these out-of-court statements be admissible if the child's available and testifies, regardless of the child's age and regardless of whether there's indicia of reliability of those statements. Frequently, from defense counsel's standpoint, they may be very good evidence. The child was laughing and joking when she told about it. The first time. But it's the history of how the child tells about it. If the child's available and testify, we have no confrontation problem and we have no hearsay problem. There are jurisdictions that define as not hearsay out-of-court statements made by a witness available to be cross-examined.
Representative Maddox.
That was exactly what I was going to ask you, because actually in administrative cases here in Oregon, we also make that exception. We say hearsay is admissible anytime the witness is available for cross-examination.
Right.
So there isn't really a confrontation problem.
No, there's no confrontation problem there. And we do not have as broad a rule in the criminal law or the evidentiary code in Oregon. I'm suggesting that we have that in this circumstance and that we draft a bill to do that.
Mr. Garner, you're much better versed and have thought about this a whole lot more than I have. But would that change result conceivably in a situation where the child might be pressured to be available to testify? Because you'd like to be able to use that language, you'd like to be able to use the statement, there is no other indicia of reliability, and so as a prosecutor, isn't it going to be an incentive for you to, in some sense, put pressure on that child to testify or be available to testify?
You can check this out with Mr. Collins as well. I will always encourage a child to testify. I would always prefer the child testifying live. That's the most compelling evidence we can present in these cases. And I would say that we don't generally pressure a child to testify. That's probably the quickest way to get them not to testify, but rather provide them with support mechanisms. I've just become familiar with an excellent video about children as witnesses produced in Lane County. So generally, we're not pressuring them at all, but we're trying to overcome and identify their fears and concerns. But we are always, in this field, attempting to have the child feel secure enough so that they can testify live on the stand in these
cases.
Okay,
but I guess I am confused then, because my recollection of the bill last session, the need for it, at least the rationale that was given to us, was that we were trying to avoid small children having to testify because of the traumatic effect of that. And matter of fact, I think we have a couple other bills
right. In
this subcommittee that further attempt to minimize the trauma that a child goes through in having to testify. So
we cannot avoid that period because the case of State versus Campbell, the Oregon Supreme Court required that the child be presented to the court to at least reach the competency determination or the other determinations that would consider a child unavailable. In other words, we can't, with defense counsel, stipulate the child's unavailable because they're incompetent. We've got to present them to the court for an inquiry. We could, however, present expert testimony similar to the doctor who testified previously, that the child was likely to suffer extreme emotional damage and not ever have to present the child in that circumstance. And I would be very blunt again, I don't think there's a DA in the state who would force a child to testify if they had heard from a doctor or a psychologist, someone qualified, that it would be, you know, the potential of irreparable emotional harm to that child if they did. I mean, that would be fairly unethical, at least immoral.
Counsel.
Just to clarify, I think what was done last session, that if you read the current law, and this does get confusing, it says if the child either testifies at a proceeding and is subject to cross-examination or is unavailable as a witness, then you still have to prove substantial indicia of reliability. What was added on top of that was that if the child was going to be unavailable, and in this situation it applies to criminal or juvenile court proceedings, if there was the additional element, I would guess, of unavailability, then there has to be corroborative evidence. So the first level is availability or non-availability. There has to be, you have to go through the many hoops in terms of substantial reliability of the statement. Then if you get past that hoop and, in fact, the child is unavailable, you also need corroborative evidence.
Mr. Chairman?
Am I correct?
Yes.
That makes sense. Is that clear to you? Clearer?
Yeah, it does.
And it only applies to children under 10.
It applies to children under 10, and in this it was only juvenile proceedings or criminal trials.
Yes. I'm learning that most of the things that I remember about last session never really happened. Representative Mannix.
Well, they may have happened in the House, but they never made it through the Senate. That's another thing. But, Mr. Gardner, you had a draft that you prepared last time that changed this language. Does that incorporate what you've been talking about right now conceptually?
Yes.
And we're in work session?
We are in work session. We do have one other individual who is here who apparently would like to say something. So,
well, about this particular approach, I'm just tempted to get moving on this.
Well, Representative Max, I'm tempted to get moving on this as well, but I want to make sure that we've got all the facts in front of us. I'm not sure.
I'll defer making any motion until we have this other witness.
Appreciate that. Okay, Mr. Gardner, go ahead.
Then there's the second area, the third area now that I felt that there's a need for a change, and that is that we have had interpretations in courts in Deschutes County that the level for admissibility defined in this statute for criminal cases and as further defined by the U.S. Constitution in the case of Idaho versus Wright, that is the same standard for admissibility of these out-of-court statements in the juvenile case. And I think what we've done is we've set up a standard for admissibility of the evidence that is higher than the standard of proof in the juvenile case. If any of you have a question about those different standards of proofs, I'd be glad to explain that again.
Would you like me to do that? Yes.
Okay. In a criminal case, if we were to picture the scales of justice, the scales begin entirely tipped in the defendant's favor. That's called the presumption of innocence. And it's the state's burden to virtually reverse the position of those scales, and that's called beyond a reasonable doubt. We don't have to entirely reverse it and prove beyond all possible doubt, but just beyond reasonable doubts in order to prevail, convict a person of a crime. In a juvenile case, the standard of proof is preponderance of the evidence. Those people who say the abuse occurred and didn't occur start off with the scales perfectly balanced. We put on some evidence here and some evidence there, and all you have to prove is that it's more likely than not that certain events occurred. As it applies to this statute and what we're talking about, let's say, for instance, and hypothetically, that we have a child who's on various occasions to various people reported that she's been sexually abused by, let's say, her natural father. We may not be able to find in the context of the criminal case and the standards put forward here that evidence is admissible. Okay? But in the context of the juvenile case, what's that mean? That means, why is the kid saying that her dad sexually abused her? Now, let's say the kid is called to the stand to testify and the judge says, can you tell me the truth? And the kid's answer is, I could tell you the truth, but I'm just too scared. And she curls up in the fetal position in the witness chair and refuses to talk any longer. Now, that child's now unavailable. Now, I'm not quarreling and don't think it's inappropriate to say that maybe we shouldn't let that in a criminal case. But in a juvenile case where the issue is, why did she say that? What's the most likely explanation of it? So at least we can take official action to protect the child, even though we may not have sufficient evidence to convict an alleged perpetrator. In the juvenile case, with the preponderance of the evidence standard, that evidence should come in. And the trier of the fact should then be able to reach a determination based on that evidence. Why did the child say this? What's the most likely explanation for it? And if they conclude the most likely explanation is that they're abused, the juvenile proceedings then give the juvenile court the authority to protect that child. So that's the different standard of proof. The standard of proof for admission of the evidence, frankly, under interpretations I've seen in courts in Oregon so far, is higher than the standard of proof to prevail in juvenile court. So we've got to get over a hurdle up here to get down here to prove the case, so we may not be able to get evidence in that would be sufficient to prove the case if it came in.
Counsel.
Clarification. Chris, your amendments, as dated January 30th, talk about juvenile proceedings and criminal proceedings. The bill in front of the committee deletes that and applies it, or actually applies it to all proceedings, whether civil or criminal. Do you have any thoughts about how any of this, if it should apply to a civil proceeding, and if so, how?
Well, frankly, my general feeling is that we should have a relatively high standard for admissibility of this hearsay evidence in a proceeding that may have a punitive effect on an individual, i.e., for instance, a damaged civil suit against an alleged perpetrator. But in any action, whether it's civil or criminal, well, there's no criminal actions that do this, where the entire inquiry is what's in the best interest of the child, ultimately, and those are basically custody cases and juvenile cases, I think we ought to get this evidence in and before the trier of the fact to be able to make that determination. Why is the child saying this? Why did the child say that? I don't see it as a particular problem in custody cases, and the reason for that is there's a recent Oregon case that holds that it is sufficient grounds to deny custody of a child to an individual if the child believes they've been abused by that individual. In other words, you don't have to prove they were abused by them. You just have to prove they thought they were abused by them.
Say that again.
There's an Oregon case that is held that is sufficient grounds to deny custody of a child to an individual if the child believes they were abused by that individual. Okay? So you don't have to prove they were actually abused, but only prove that they believe that they were abused by that person.
Is that a Court of Appeals case or a Supreme Court case?
I believe it's a Court of Appeals case, and I don't have the site with me right now.
Would you send that to me, please?
Sure.
Representative Parks.
Do you know the name of it, where they have the site?
Right, not right off the top of my head.
We'll ask Mr. Gardner to make that available to us. I think that
I can find
raises,
it.
Raises some eyebrows.
Okay, I have it in a file somewhere. And the reason that then this rule doesn't have a consequence in those cases is that another exception to the hearsay rule are statements, out-of-court statements. It's exception number 3, a statement of the declarant's then existing state of mind. So if the issue is what does the child believe, and the child has said so-and-so abused me out of court, then that evidence comes in under exception 3 to the hearsay rule. Okay, to prove the child's state of mind, i.e. that she believes the person did it. It's not available to prove the person did it, but that's an irrelevant inquiry. Under that standard of proof. So right. I don't see that as a real critical problem. I do, however, see this happening frequently, that we have happening at the same time a criminal case, a juvenile case, and a civil case, and we can't resolve the issues in the civil case because we don't have the tools to get the evidence before the trier of fact, and therefore we're forced then maybe to file a juvenile case when it could have been resolved in the custody situation had the evidence come in. But I think that problem's eroding as this case and other things come along.
Counsel.
You didn't answer my question, though.
Okay.
And, Chris, in the way that you wrote this, it was applying only to criminal and juvenile proceedings. do you object?
No.
I mean, other than making it constitutionally sound for criminal cases, I'm assuming that you would want the same things applying basically in juvenile court proceedings as you would in civil proceedings.
Yes.
That's what I wanted to hear.
Yes.
That's the question I wanted answered. Thank you.
And then I believe that there are just a few other sort of technical matters, one of which is to define the timing of the hearing, which
Mr. Gardner,
is not done in the statute.
I'm going to stop you there with your four main proposals.
Okay.
The reason I'm going to do that is because of the time element that we're looking at today.
Okay.
I want to make sure we get a chance to work through at least those four major proposals that you've brought us, and then if we need to come back and revisit those other issues, we can do that.
Well, actually, we only got the three of them, and the fourth one is to amend Section 24 to be consistent with Maryland versus Gates, which allows the exclusion of a perpetrator in videotape testimony. And that's a federal constitutional standard. But
that's number three in your other problems.
Mr. Chairman, could we ask him very briefly to outline and reference his amendments? Could you just, one, two, three, four.
I'll tell you, could I do that in writing and get that back to you? It would be a little easier.
Well, here's what we're ready to move on the bill today.
Okay.
That's the urgency that you're sensing.
What I'm asking you to do is a little trick. If you will briefly outline and reference your amendment.
I think counsel is going to be able to do that for us.
Yeah, if you can outline and reference it.
And hold on, let me ask, are there any other screaming questions for Mr. Gardner? If not, we're going to ask you to stick around.
Okay.
My issue, Mr. Chair, and I've mentioned it to Mr. Gardner, and I still feel uncomfortable about it, is the way the lower standard for admission of hearsay evidence in the dependency case dovetails into the capacity then that the prosecutor has to sort of piggyback the charge in the criminal case on the evidence that is heard in the civil case.
It would be my understanding that, let's say, for instance, we proceeded with the juvenile case first, which is generally unlikely because that could result in res judicata and the inability to then proceed with the criminal case. But if we were, the fact that it were admissible there doesn't overcome the constitutional barriers to admissibility in the criminal case and doesn't eradicate the doesn't in any way change the barriers for admissibility there. So we're in a situation, I don't think that opening the gates in one to one area, open the gates in the other, and I don't see a way that that could happen. I guess maybe it could happen in a sense of like the rumor got around the courthouse sort of thing, but once again, I don't see that as a real serious problem, and I understand you're concerned with it. But,
okay. Thank you. All right, we are in work session. Counsel. You made amazing promises of what you could do here for us in terms of outlining the proposed amendments.
Can I start with the easiest one first?
Summarizing, yes.
Page 3, line 44, there are -1 amendments that do this. Regardless of what happens, that has to be broadened to include juvenile, civil, and criminal cases. The word juvenile has to be added because they are not considered civil proceedings.